Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, beyond the headlines with sharp insights and expert analysis from the leaders and decision makers shaping the future. Whether you're tuning in live or catching up later, stay ahead with the stories that really matter. And coming up in the next 30 minutes, export hurdles threaten South Africa's citrus boom as the industry now calls for urgent reform. Can Budget 2025 deliver real growth, or are we just going to hear another wish list? Sam Nujoma's legacy as Namibia reflects on its future, and love or luxury, the big business behind Valentine's Day spending. Now, South Africa's citrus industry is one of the biggest in the world. Bet you didn't know that. Employing something in the region of 140,000 people and obviously contributing significantly to our economy. But getting our fruit from farms to international markets, I read, is becoming a bigger challenge due to inefficiencies at ports and also on the rail network. Now, following President Ramaphosa's recent State of the Nation address, the Citrus Growers Association is now calling for urgent action to ensure that promised reforms, particularly in Transnet and the broader logistics sector, are actually implemented. I'm in conversation now with Justin Chadwick, who's the Chief Executive Officer of the Citrus Growers Association of South Africa. Justin, a very warm welcome to you. Maybe before we talk about the problems, I've just mentioned how crucial the citrus industry is to our economy. Give me an idea of size, impact, and importance as far as international trade is concerned.
Yeah, thanks, Jeremy, and thanks for having me on the show. The citrus industry employs, as you mentioned, about 140,000 people and generates sort of 30 billion in foreign exchange earnings. In terms of exports, we export to 120 countries around the world, so it's very diversified. And it's the second biggest exporter in the world after Spain, and the biggest in the Southern Hemisphere. So it's got a critical mass, and a lot of people depend on the industry.
Now, the president highlighting Transnet reforms and public-private partnership in the State of the Nation address, but we've heard this before. From your industry's perspective, how urgent is it becoming for real logistics improvements, and what would those entail?
No, extremely urgent, Jeremy. So the size of the industry now in terms of cartons, 15-kilogram cartons, is 165 million cartons. We anticipate that can go up to 260 million cartons in the space of the next 7 years or so until 2032. And to do that, we need efficient logistics. The exporting game, you need road and rail to work, and you need the ports to work. So it's becoming more and more important. And, you know, the discussion around port reform and improvements have been going on for many years. I guess the positive is that it's still being discussed. The negative is that there's no real improvement. And we firmly believe that the private sector involvement in the ports is essential to bring in the needed investment in infrastructure and equipment, particularly in the Durban port, which is where most of our fruit moves through. I'm actually sitting at the Durban port at the moment, looking across at the cranes, etc. And, you know, they've got amazing management in the ports, in Durban port. We know all the people that are trying to make it work, but they simply do not have the tools to do the job efficiently. And if we're going to achieve those 260 million cartons and generate another 100,000 jobs and another sort of 20 billion in foreign exchange earnings, then these ports and the rail, et cetera, has to work.
Right now, what is this inefficiency costing the industry?
Yeah, we're looking at numbers. It's upwards of a billion rand a year in terms of what the delays are causing. We've actually just asked the Bureau of Food and Agriculture Policy to do a study for us, which they haven't completed yet. And then we'll have a better idea of exactly the cost to the industry, but it's not small. It's an extremely big number.
You've spoken to me about taking some encouragement regarding commitment, although not a lot is happening. But we also know government has committed to allowing private operators onto the rail network. Obviously, this would have a positive impact, I imagine. But you're going to wait a while before you see changes, I think.
Yeah, these processes aren't small. You know, government needs to go through the correct procedures in terms of, awarding tenders or awarding joint venture partnerships, etc. So we understand that. But in the ports, we were told that the private sector was the JV was concluded last year and would start in April. Now we know through various legal problems that's been delayed. It is very encouraging to see the rail network statement and the intent to bring in private sector onto the rail, into the rail environment. And, that might move a bit quicker. It's really essential. I don't know how many times, Jeremy, you've driven between Johannesburg and Durban, but it's really a conveyor belt of trucks in the inside lane. It's really dangerous, not only for the truck drivers, but for other road users. And we really need a lot of that cargo taken off the road and put onto rail, which is far more efficient.
When you raise these frustrations with government, with whom you're ever talking to, are you getting a sense that you're being heard?
I think we're being heard, and I think they understand the problems. I think the solutions aren't so easy and aren't so clear. We do hear of ideas that sound really, really good, but it's implementation that seems to be the problem. As I say, with the JV on Durban Pier 2 at the Durban port was really encouraging, but now it's being held back. So yes, we do try and ensure that we engage with the ministers and with the high level people. But we've yet to see a whole deal of action.
But you would be concerned when you see reports saying that Transnet needs more financial assistance from government. In other words, a bailout.
Definitely. Funding is at the key of the problem. As I said earlier, if you have a look at the equipment in the ports, specifically Durban port and probably Cape Town port as well, the equipment's seriously aged and it hasn't been maintained adequately, etc. So you see, I think if I remember my figures correctly, they're meant to be like 120 cranes operating in Durban, and there's something like 50. The rest are not working. So definitely, that's money to fix all of that we need. And I don't know if bailouts are the best way. There are other alternatives like the private sector participation.
When we have these delays and log jams, as you've pointed out to me, Justin, is there a lot of wastage? Do you have to discard fruit?
We're quite fortunate in the citrus industry, and in that the citrus industry is quite the oranges and lemons and grapefruit and mandarins are actually quite a resilient fruit. They're not that perishable, so in effect we can store the fruit a little bit longer than say table grapes and berries. They're the ones that really suffer. If they have a week delay, I mean, that's disastrous for those highly perishable products, plums, peaches, etc. as well. For citrus, we it's a bit more, we get a bit longer period before it really starts impacting on the quality of the fruit.
But there comes a point where those warehouses become full and there's new product coming down the supply chain.
Yeah, that's exactly the problem. Congestion in the port, but then also timing in the market. If you miss a week because of shipping delays or whatever, that week's worth of sales isn't recovered later. So that's the real a big problem. It's a big problem for us towards the end of the 2024 season when a number of vessels were delayed and we had a few weeks when there was short supply in the market, and then suddenly this huge volume arrives in the market and then the price crashes. So it's all about market dynamics and being able to ratably supply into the market so that the consumer has fruit available the whole time and the price doesn't fluctuate all over the place.
Well, at some point we'll circle back and see what sort of progress is being made. Justin Chadwick, thank you very much indeed, the Chief Executive Officer of the Citrus Growers Association of Southern Africa.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
In PwC's new annual Global Chief Executive Officer survey, around 83% of CEOs in this country polled say they expect local economic growth to increase this year, while most economists are predicting something of an increase as well. The big consultancy goes on to say for Budget 2025 to work, it needs to be something that encourages the business community and to lift sentiment by providing an update on progress made in key economics and structural reforms, as well as more concrete solutions towards the country's energy and logistical challenges. The big question, of course, will the finance minister deliver on that next Wednesday? Let's get a view from Lulu Kruchel, who is chief economist at PwC. Lulu, a very warm welcome to you. So PwC warning that fiscal budgets have a history of overestimating economic growth and expected revenues. I guess the question is, why should we trust the Treasury's projections this time? And what realistic growth rate should businesses be planning for?
Yeah, Jeremy, unfortunately, we tend to, and especially Treasury tends to, overestimate things on the positive end, expecting higher tax collections, lower debt levels and higher growth levels than we have unfortunately seen. A couple of years ago, I think it's about 2 or 3 years, we got it right. But before that, unfortunately, we didn't. So it creates a bit of a feeling of, should we trust these numbers, as you say? And I think our view is not that it would be complete dire straits, but, you know, it will probably be lower than if we look at the SARB's predictions at the moment of around 1.9%. Probably towards the middle of the range, between 1 and 2%, around 1.5% would probably be more realistic. Unfortunately, last year we also seem to have gotten it wrong, overestimating growth. And I think at the moment, there's just so many uncertainties. And yes, you can't always take the negative view on the uncertainties, but rather be prudent, be a little bit more prudent around debt, around expenditure, around growth, and get a clear message out there to the market.
Lulu, the single biggest problem I would contend is the rise in government debt. There are promises all the time of fiscal discipline, but deficits remain high. At what point do you think we face a full-blown debt crisis? And if it happens, what are the consequences?
Yeah, unfortunately, as you say, that's also something that is not, our debt levels haven't gone down to the levels we would have liked to. And again, it's about growth, about tax collections, and then unexpected expenditure that has been coming our way. If you look at the salary increases from government side, they didn't settle at the rates that they think they would settle, and it's been a few years in a row now. And in, combined with all of that, yes, it's maybe not such a big expenditure item, but if you look at the PEPFAR funding that we got from the US, you know, that's another hole that government needs to fill. So the social relief grant that the Gauteng High Court actually said, but you have to continue and you have to increase it. You know, so all these unexpected things, and we seem to not be planning for them, which is a little bit concerning for me, because if you think about, I mean, it's in essence a business that we're running and the government's running. We should have, there are some contingencies, but I think we should think through those more carefully. And as you say, full-blown debt crisis means that there are a lot of things that we really need that we won't be able to fund. If we are looking for additional funds, it will come at a higher cost. So it's like somebody defaulting on their, you know, on their home loan or other repayments. And also the signal that it will send to investors and to the market is you need to think twice before investing in South Africa.
So, Lulu, you talk about planning, which I think is very important. The government, in terms of that, is always talking about narrowing the deficit, reducing debt, yet the spending pressures, as you've just mentioned to me, keep rising. So come budget day next Wednesday, are there key fiscal reforms that the minister needs to point to that need to be implemented to stop this financial bleeding?
Yeah, so I think we need transparency in terms of how certain of these surprises will be funded. If you think about something like the social relief grant, when it was initially introduced during COVID in 2020, the thinking was, on the message was, oh, this is only going to be temporary. And I suppose we all looked at it and realized this is going to be very difficult to turn around. So there's not been necessarily a clear roadmap to say, this is what we're going to do. This is what we're going to do by that point in time. If you think about an income grant, a basic income grant, there's been talk about that for so long. And in most people's view is that the social relief grant is kind of a, you know, a precursor and should have been a precursor for that. But we haven't had clarity. So social funding, in my opinion, is probably one of the areas where we really need transparency, clarity, and also plans about how are we going to turn around the reliance on some of these. I mean, I realize that, you know, we have such high unemployment rates and then employed poor in South Africa. So it's not just simply a case of let's remove these things. We cannot do that. But, you know, how are we really going to focus on creating confidence, business confidence? Because that's the job of fiscal policy, is to actually say, we create confidence so that you can invest and that we can grow the economy. We can't do that through government spending, but it's really about, you know, how are we bringing investors along on the journey.
It's common cause that there is weak state capacity. So what can government do to incentivize the private sector more to become involved in key infrastructure projects? And I don't need to say energy and logistics are where the focus needs to be. Can the minister point to any tax policies or regulatory shifts that could facilitate this?
Yeah, so I think over the last couple of months and years, we need to recognize that there's been a lot done, you know, with private sector and government working together on certain of these areas. I know that there's these task forces with the CEOs of some of the large companies involved, etc. So I think there's been good progress made there, and we cannot ignore that. What is just interesting for me is if you look at something like renewable energy and, you know, maybe water is energy is almost, I want to say, it's already, you know, we already there. The next big thing that's coming, and we know that it's not coming, it's with us already, is water. So for me, I would really like to see government say, how can we incentivize private sector? We seem to have an approach and a policy, and I understand partially where National Treasury is coming with that. But if you look at, for example, what Europe is currently doing, yes, they're stepping back on some of the regulation around carbon and energy, etc., but at the same time they're also incentivizing businesses. So that's the one thing. And the other thing that a lot of, you know, businesses have been complaining about is, yes, you introduce carbon taxes, yes, you introduce the plastic bag levered sugar taxes, but you refuse to actually focus that spending on the areas where that is right. needed. So that is also something that I'm hoping to see that we will get into.
No question, the stakes are very high and a lot to play for. Lulu Kruchel, thank you very much indeed. Chief Economist at PwC.
MoneyWeb at midday. Top stories to keep your eyes and ears on.
Now, a passing that I think has received sparse or little coverage in South Africa this past week. Sam Nujoma, the activist and guerrilla leader who became Namibia's first democratically elected president after it won independence from apartheid South Africa. And he died last week on Saturday. Nujoma rose to head the thinly populated Southern African country on March the 21st, 1990, and was formally recognized as the founding father of the Namibian nation through an act of parliament in 2005. Well, let's look back, and with me now is someone who has closely covered his life, Gwen Lister, journalist and founder of the Namibian newspaper. Gwen, a very warm welcome, and maybe looking back at his leadership, when all is said and done, did his governance fulfill the aspirations of those who had fought for liberation in the country?
That's a good question. Thanks for having me on, Jeremy. You know, I think Sam Nujoma as a liberation leader is probably how he will best be remembered. He was seen as something of an authoritarian back in the day. And of course, in that Cold War era, in which the struggle was being fought, he was seen as a communist and all things bad in the Western world. Come independence, and as you've mentioned, he was elected our first democratically elected head of state. He served three terms in office And I think as a fairly authoritarian leader back then, democracy didn't necessarily sit comfortably with him. And yet at the same time, it must be said that he committed himself to that end. He presided over one of the most democratic constitutions on the African continent, certainly at that time, and he promoted the policy of reconciliation. So there were areas where Nyoma, who was the feared liberation leader, actually surprised people by his commitment to democracy. So a bit of a mixed bag, but undoubtedly I think he'll be remembered as an icon of the struggle, and more than he will be remembered as a committed democratic president of Namibia.
And Gwen, post-independence, did his policies help or hinder the economic development of the country?
I think if you had to ask Nyoma today, he would say that he was very proud of Namibia's peace and stability, because overall it has been pretty much that way since independence. But I would say, as someone who told me back in the 80s that he wanted Namibia to be the first success story of Africa, and those were his exact words, I think he would be incredibly disappointed at the fact that in economic terms, Namibia is where it is today, which is not in a good place. Unemployment is said to be nearing 40%. Some say it's a lot higher than that. And in those terms, the people have not received what he once hoped they would, namely those fruits of independence, as it's termed. So I think that would probably be his biggest disappointment, and the fact that he could not quite achieve his goal of getting Namibia to that prime spot of sort of the most successful country in Africa.
And Gwen, in 2025, does his legacy still influence Namibia's democracy? Does the ruling party still operate to an extent in his shadow?
Yes, I think it undoubtedly does. You know, when he stepped down in 2005 after the three terms, and again, he surprised people. Most people thought he was in that league of the presidents for life that characterized the African continent at that time. But he didn't. He went quietly in 2005. He obviously had a lot of influence in choosing his successors, both his immediate successor, who was President Hifikepunye Pohamba, Namibia's second president, and then the third, President Hage Geingob as well. So undoubtedly, he was influential behind the scenes. And I think SWAPO, as it goes forward, has always in the past even found it difficult to kind of make the transition from being a liberation movement to a political party committed to democracy. And yes, I think that Nyoma, for the foreseeable future, will still be a shadow that looms over SWAPO and its decisions in the years to come.
And Gwen, in terms of Namibia's foreign policy and current regional standing, do you think it's improved since his era, or is it still shaped again by past liberation struggles?
I think still very much shaped by past liberation struggles. In that respect, I mean, I think I was one of the major critics of Namibia, which has this wonderful constitution and a very committed democracy, could not kind of spread that gospel further afield, if you like. As you're aware, Namibia was and has been in the past couple of years in the top three as far as the Reporters Sans Frontières press freedom rankings are concerned. There's been a strong commitment to democracy, press freedom and free press. But at the same time, Namibia seems unable to kind of exercise that further afield, like, and still remains kind of in that Cold War era of commitment to the kind of non-aligned movement type thinking, alliances with Cuba, with China, and with the traditional allies of the still a little bit less forward-thinking than many of us would have liked.
And Gwen Lister, what about young Namibians? Many would be born or would have been born after independence. Are they looking at or reassessing his legacy? I wonder if they view him as a hero or part of the system that frustrates him, given the reference that you made to huge political and or economic inequality.
Well, you know, I think our last elections last year have sort of shown that SWAPO's traditional sort of majority everywhere is fast being eroded, much as is happening in other parts of the subcontinent. The youth are getting increasingly frustrated. As I said earlier, they do not feel that they have got what they deserve in terms of post-independence development and economic progress. And of course, there's widespread unemployment. And I think the election results showed SWAPO was quite considerably, had a bit of a bloody nose in terms of the parliamentary election results. Obviously, the new incoming president, who is Netumbo Nandi-Ndaitwa, did get overwhelming support. So that sort of grassroots support for SWAPO is still there, but it's been fast eroding. And I think unless SWAPO really do things in the coming years to change what is happening, especially in economic terms in Namibia, I think there could be a new party coming into power in the next elections.
And let me finish this conversation by asking you for a personal recollection. You knew him, you interviewed him. What can you tell me?
Well, you know, I remember meeting him as a young journalist in Paris in 1983, I think it was, and I was kind of pretty intimidated. He was always larger than life. You know, much of what we'd heard about him back here in Namibia was as this guerrilla leader, you know, dressed in fatigues, very tough and very uncompromising. Much of the propaganda of those years about him and about SWAPO kind of got to a lot of us. So I was quite intimidated, but I do recall that one of the first things he did was sort of gesture towards a bar to say, what would you like to drink? And I said, if possible, a cup of tea. And a huge smile broke over his face. He was absolutely delighted. He was someone who really opposed alcohol abuse. And one of the first messages he gave me to bring back home to Namibians was that they must stop drinking alcohol. So that kind of broke the ice. And at the time, I found him a very warm and welcoming person who respected my journalistic commitment to Namibia's independence. But of course, later and after independence itself, that would change. And as the Namibian held the SWAPO government to account, Nyoma quickly became sort of, was not very pleased with me. And that resulted in him putting a ban in terms of government purchase and advertising in the Namibian in the year 2000, a ban that lasts for 10 years until his successor lifted that ban.
The life and legacy of Sam Nyoma. Thank you very much indeed, Gwen Lister.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now to red roses. I don't need to tell you, Valentine's Day is a big business. Every year, millions are spent on flowers, chocolates, and gifts. But have you ever stopped to think about the economics behind it? Why do red roses suddenly become a whole lot more expensive? What goes into making sure that thousands of love-struck customers get their gifts on time? Well, I want to discuss the business side of romance. I'm joined by Savannah Plaskett, head of marketing at NetFlorist, one of South Africa's largest online gifting platforms. Savannah, good evening to you and a very warm welcome. So, Valentine's Day, how busy are you guys?
Hi, Jeremy, and hi to your listeners. Valentine's Day is very busy for us. Love is definitely in the air in South Africa at the moment. This is our busiest time by very far. We grow by almost 300% over Valentine's Day.
So I'm assuming as we're having this conversation, and I have been to your packing warehouse before, there are people right now loading bunches of flowers into vases and making sure they get into the delivery vehicles. It's a real logistics challenge, isn't it?
Absolutely. So as soon as the previous Valentine's Day ends, we start preparing for the next year. So we get started straight away. Over Valentine's Day, we bring in additional people to help us make the magic happen, to make sure that everyone receives the gifts. This year, we're expecting to deliver 20,000 gifts, which means that there's 50,000 people across South Africa feeling the love and feeling the connection that that gift brings.
Red roses, as I mentioned in the introduction, are still the go-to flower for Valentine's Day, I imagine. Is that still true, or are people becoming a little more creative and imaginative? Are they opting for other gifts and experiences?
Absolutely. So it's the red roses' time of year to shine. Although the style of arrangements and the fillers and accompanying flowers may change every year, the bestseller for the 26th year in a row for us is still the very impactful red rose bouquet. It's a symbol of love, and it's what's been associated with Valentine's Day. We're seeing an increase in pink roses for Valentine's Day, as well as sunflowers being a South African favorite. But it's the red roses' absolute best time of year.
Having said that, though, we know that pricing always spikes around Valentine's Day. It's like the Uber surge pricing, particularly for flowers. What drives the price increases, and is there anything that customers can do to get better deals?
The incredibly high demand over the occasion drives the higher price. Customers can look at florists that are able to give them a better price. These are usually florists like us that are working directly with the suppliers to secure stock months in advance instead of waiting for the flower market prices to fluctuate and buying red roses much closer to Valentine's Day.
And Savannah, have you noticed any shifts this year in consumer behavior? Are people spending more or less on Valentine's Day gifts? Given that for many of us, while the day is important and it can be a fun day, a lot of people are under financial pressure.
The people who are able to treat and spoil their special people are definitely going all out this year, like every year. We've seen the trend continue where this is a very big occasion for us. South Africans want to spoil each other. They want to use it as an opportunity to do something special for once in the year. So although like other businesses within the country, we've been impacted by the change in the economy, we're still seeing people show out and show up for the people they love.
Flowers and perishable gifts, in other words, chocolates, for instance, which I'm sure you also do good business in, means that logistics has got to be very well planned. How difficult is it to get fresh flowers and other perishables to customers on time in the right condition? That can be difficult sometimes.
Absolutely, it can. We have 26 years of practice in making our customers as happy as possible to receive their gifts. We work very closely with a cold chain process to make sure there's an end-to-end cold chain happening so that when the flowers arrive at the recipient, they are as fresh as when they left the farm. And we take a lot of pride in delivering fresh flowers on time.
Also, I think it's fair to say that personalization is now a big trend in gifting. How has NetFlorist adapted to this? And have you had to deal with some unusual requests?
We've seen a global trend in personalization increase over the last decade. Customers want to make their gifts unique by adding the recipient's name, a special message, or even a photo. And senders want to be able to show the thoughtfulness and make the gift special for the recipient. We have increased the amount of machines we have to be able to offer more personalized gifts, more diversity of products that can be personalized, as well as a much bigger range. We are seeing this as our biggest growing trend within South Africa. Our best-selling gift of the year that's not a flower so far is actually a personalized gift. It's a personalized glass display tile, which is a sleek glass piece, like a small glass photo frame that you can put on your desk that you can add a photo and a special message to.
And Savannah, just a final question, and I might or might not be asking this question on my own personal behalf and that of my engineer, Ed, but how do you deal with last-minute shoppers? Is there a cut-off time for same-day deliveries? Some of us might be panicked on February the 14th if, Savannah, we have forgotten to do what we should have done.
Absolutely. So my job is to make sure as many people as possible remember Valentine's Day as early as possible in February. But if you have left it to the last minute, don't worry. We're still open for orders in order to make your day special. If everything is closed and you've run out of ideas, a thoughtful message and a note is better than nothing at all.
Are you listening to that, Ed? He's nodding his head. I hope he is. Savannah, thank you very much indeed.
You still have time.
We still have time. I know that you have a very, very busy evening ahead of you. Thank you so much for joining us. Savannah Plaskett is Head of Marketing at NetFlorist. And that's our program for today. We're back on Monday with another 30 minutes looking at issues driving South Africa's business, political and social environment. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.